Conferences 9 and 10 of John Cashin are two of the classical expositions from the Egyptian desert of the monastic tradition of prayer. It is important for us to bear in mind that Cashin is the principal means by which this tradition was exported to the West. These texts were read and constantly reflected upon throughout the late patristic and well into the medieval and modern periods, especially in monastic communities. Cashin is overwhelmingly important, and so what he recommends has significantly influenced Western monastic practice in ways that cannot be overstated. Conference 9 is a kind of preparation for the precise description of the monologistic prayer formula that Abba Isaac bestows or offers in Conference 10. There, Abba Isaac, as we shall see, recommends the use of the phrase, "O God, come to my assistance, O Lord, make haste to help me," as a monologistic prayer that can be used in any situation and which can lead, if used properly, to the highest kind of experience of God, the fiery prayer, which Cashin will describe here in Conference 9. But it's helpful for us in considering first this preparatory Conference 9 to be aware that that monologistic formula, as Cashin calls it in Conference 10, is anticipated in this conference by a very clear and specific description and even commentary on the Lord's Prayer, which Cashin calls a formula here as well. This is possibly a suggestion of the tradition in the medieval and late patristic West of using the Lord's Prayer either in part or in whole as a kind of monologistic prayer as well. As we shall see when we consider the development of the rosary in the West, these beads, which were used to count prayers, were originally used to count repetitions of the Our Father, the Pater Noster, and so what we would think is a rosary in paintings and depictions of medieval holy people is actually called a paternoster. And it wasn't really until the 13th and 14th centuries that there was a significant shift from the repetition or recitation of the Lord's Prayer in regular and repeated form to recitations of the Hail Mary. So it's possible that Cashin's recommendation here of the Lord's Prayer as a formula was itself part of the spiritual reason for the popularity of that particular practice during the medieval West. With that kind of background, let's look at the text of Conference 9 itself. It really begins with Chapter 2, in which Cashin describes the goal of the monk. So if you would drop down to Chapter 2, there he says that the goal of the monk is what we would call contemplative prayer. He says in Chapter 2, number 1, "The aim of every monk and the perfection of his heart is to continual and unbroken perseverance in prayer." So, continual, unbroken, prayer without ceasing. And he says, "As far as it's allowed to human frailty, to acquire an immovable tranquility of mind and a perpetual purity." This subject of prayer, which is both continuous and, as he puts it, pure, is really the subject of his next section, Chapter 3. So if you drop down to Chapter 3, he talks about a prayer which he describes in the first sections, in paragraphs 1 and 2 of Chapter 3, and then a little further on, of prayer that is free from sin, prayer that involves a willingness to lay aside all of the dark things that keep us from experiencing the light of God. But then he moves on and says that this pure prayer is also prayer that is free not only from sin, but also free from distraction as well. So purity of prayer in Chapter 4 becomes a description of what he calls prayer with the lightness of a feather, prayer that can be lifted on high to a very great and very pure form of spiritual meditation, not weighed down either by sinfulness or, as he goes on to describe in Chapter 5, by any of the vices that may afflict us, but in addition, and now drop down to Chapter 6, even by distraction. So he's concerned that this continuous, pure prayer also be an undistracted prayer. So freedom from distraction becomes a kind of extended part of his definition of what purity of prayer consists of. And it's rather amusing in a certain way that in Chapter 6 he suggests that distractions can even consist of good jobs that were given if we are doing them in the wrong spirit, or if we're doing them excessively, or engaging in a practice which in itself is neutral, but which is not actually serving any good purpose. Frittering away our time is also a way of making our prayer impure. If we drop down now to chapter 7, we'll see that he asks the question, how can we retain holy thoughts, that is to say, positive meditations when we read the scriptures or have an insight in prayer and suddenly we have a sense or a glimpse of something holy and good? Why is it that these good thoughts vanish so quickly, and how can we hold on to them? How can we continuously hold these in our heart? Well, he doesn't actually answer that question here in Conference 9, but in Conference 10, he will suggest that the use of a formula prayer is one way of holding on to holy thoughts. So this is a kind of a teaser or an anticipation of something which he will answer to a greater extent in his next conference. Now, the next section of this conference, it's sort of the fourth block of the conference, consists of chapters number 8 to 16. And if we drop down now to chapter 8, we'll see that he begins now to describe different kinds of prayer, including, and this is a very important theme, especially here in Conference 9, but also to a lesser extent in Conference 10, what he calls ardent or fiery prayer. And by this he means a kind of prayer which is a gift, it can't be merited, it cannot be artificially created, but in which, in some sense, our prayers are like, it is as if a flint was struck and the dry straw of our prayer suddenly ignites. Without having to work at it, we're suddenly carried up, in a sense, towards God. So he'll describe a fiery prayer as well as other types. Now, the other types of prayer, if we drop down to chapter 9, which he will now describe in detail, are actually based on Origen's description of prayer in his treatise, De Oratione, Periprosiuces, on prayer. And in it, he divides prayer up into four different kinds, which are the same sorts of things that that Cashin does. He describes supplication, prayer, or a vow, and supplication is the subject of chapter 11. Of prayer in the sense of a vow is the subject of chapter 12. Dropping down to chapter 13, he speaks of intercession, and then in chapter 14 of thanksgiving. This is Cashin's reprise in Latin of Origen's great treatise on prayer. And then in chapter 15, Cashin adds something rather unique to himself, although it is prefigured and foreshadowed to some extent at Origen and in the Alexandrian tradition, and that is his notion of fiery prayer, an ardent prayer. Drop down to chapter 15. He says, occasionally, these four kinds can, he says, proceed into or give rise to a most fervent and ardent kind of prayer. And then dropping down towards the bottom of that paragraph to the highlighted text, with fervent hearts lifted up to that ardent prayer which cannot be embraced or expressed by the mouth of human beings. He then describes it in chapter 15, paragraph 2. It is like an all-devouring flame. It darts through all of them and offers up to God inexpressible prayers of the purest force, prayers which transcend words. So he's describing now a wonderful spiritual experience that happens on occasion. This is something to which he will recur regularly in this conference, and there are some very intriguing studies, and I've listed in particular Columbus Stewart's description of Cashin's doctrine on prayer in his book Cashin the Monk. He considers this fiery or ardent prayer, which is also a truly ecstatic prayer in his chapters 6 and 7 of that book. It's ecstatic in the sense that for Cashin, this involves the soul in some sense being lifted up above itself, which is different from Evagrius. For Evagrius, the contemplation of God occurs within the nous, and one sees in the heart this glowing light of the self. But for Cashin, it's as if we are lifted up in a kind of a fiery way above ourselves. If we now drop down to chapter 18, having described using Origen these four classical ways of prayer, now he says that in many ways the Lord's Prayer is or can be fiery prayer. There is a still more sublime and exalted condition described with fervent love, and it has to do with what he calls in 18:2 the formula of the Lord's Prayer. And I emphasize the use of this word because in Conference 10, the word formula will be used to describe this particular prayer that is to be recited regularly within the heart in order to elevate the soul. Well, the Lord's Prayer is also, he says here, a formula. And from this point onward, for a significant part of the rest of the conference, he will now divide the Lord's Prayer up into its different sections, beginning with Our Father at the beginning of chapter 18, who art in heaven, and then hallowed be your name. And then in chapter 19, he describes the phrase, your kingdom come. And continues on in chapter 20 and 21, he goes on to give us this day. Chapters 22 and 23, continuing his explication. He then in chapter 24 tells us that the Lord's Prayer is a method and form of prayer proposed to us by Christ himself, and to be strongly recommended and emphasized. And then in chapter 25, if you would drop down, he now says that the Lord's Prayer can be an occasion of this fiery prayer. If prayed in the right way, in the right spirit, the Lord's Prayer can be a means by which we are lifted up. This, he says in 25:1, this Lord's Prayer can lift the soul to, he says, that ardent prayer which is ineffable, which transcends word, transcends even all thought. No movement of the tongue or utterance of the word can happen, but in the shortest possible space of time, there is, in a sense, he says, we are an emulation of Christ who poured forth his prayers in silence. He returns to this theme of fiery prayer in chapter 26, where he describes it in more cataphatic terms. In chapter 25, he described it as ineffable, beyond words. But in chapter 26, as you see numbered here, there are six different very cataphatic contexts. Now, this is not so much the Lord's Prayer as an occasion of fiery or ardent prayer, but he says there are other things as well. Beginning in 26:1 with a verse from the Psalms. That can lift us up into fiery prayer. Sometimes hearing the psalm sung well, or having it recited well, or when we hear the exhortation or spiritual conference, we might say a very good homily, this can lift us up to that kind of ardent prayer. Or when we experience the compunction, the sorrow that comes from hearing that someone has died, gone to God, or when we're aware of our own coldness, our own dullness of heart, that awareness can sometimes paradoxically spark again within us this kind of experience of a fiery prayer, which he recaps again in chapter 27 and talks about it as something about the mind hiding in itself in complete silence within the secrets of a profound quiet at some moments, and now he moves on to one of his final themes, the gift of tears. Sometimes our prayer breaks forth in an external expression of contrition or compunction, this experience of tears, which Evagrius treats in very great detail. Cashin mentions it here, particularly in chapters 28 and 29, and even on to chapter 30. He mentions that these tears are both of sorrow or repentance, but they are also of joy, and they shouldn't be forced. They're nothing that we should force. Instead, we should accept them when they happen, and they are to be regarded as a good thing. He then has a rather longish section beginning in chapter 32, attempting to answer the question how our prayers are answered, even when they don't seem to be answered. And that's of some interest, and I would invite you to peruse that as you have time. And then finally, in chapter 35, he describes silent and brief prayer. He concludes with this emphasis on the fact that we are to pray, as he says, with closed doors, that is to say, in silence, and our prayer is to be brief. Now this, again, as I mentioned before, is a kind of a prelude to, a preparation for, Conference 10, in which, if you look at the very last words of this conference, he says he has not understood the discourse in its nature and the power or the means by which continuing in prayer might be gained and kept, Well, to some extent, that will be answered by the use of the formula that Abba Isaac provides in Conference 10. But always remember, in Conference 9 here too, the Lord's Prayer is also a formula, something that can be recited and repeated in the heart, and which Cashin apparently believes has the power to elevate and lift up the soul.